hidden, did you?
Well, not significant, but the sequence of minerals that
was names.
What the meaning of the
planet. Okay, we're prepared.
Is this thing on? We're prepared to start. We're missing one of our panelists at this time, but as soon as Dr. Gast arrives, we will bring him in with us. At this point, I'll turn the program over to Dr. Simmons.
Well, I think the way we'll handle today's discussion is to, for me, simply to introduce the members here for you and then turn to two in succession and ask for general statements of their impressions. And then maybe we can come up with a dialogue amongst some of the panel members. Play it that way for a while until we ran out of something to say, but looking down the group here, I guess that'd be a hell of a long time before that happened. So I'll cut it off somewhere, and we'll turn to you people for questions in order to clarify points that may have escaped. Our purpose here is to provide you with a so-called wrap-up session of the entire conference, not just this morning's proceedings. I think most of you recognize that now. I have the general impression that a few of you have given to me that there is considerable confusion in the minds of at least one or two members of the press as to what all of this large amount of data might mean. I guess I ought to confess, in case there's any misconception on the part of you, that I too have this general impression for myself. Other panel members, I'm sure, do not share that problem. Well, let me proceed with the introductions. My name, as I said, is Gene Simmons. I'm chief scientist at MSC. Next to me is Dr. Robert Jastrow of some kind of space institute. Forgive me.
The Institute for Space Studies.
The Institute for Space Studies.
That's New York.
And next to him is Dr. Robert Walker of Washington University. Next to him is Professor Ed Anders of the University of Chicago and Professor Ian McGregor of the University of California at Santa Barbara. At Davis. Forgive me again. I would like to turn to Bob Jastrow for a few brief comments.
I'm outside the major professions that were active in this discussion, and until recently, the names of these peculiar minerals were as foreign to me as to you. Each of them is actually the minerals that is pregnant with meaning for the history of the planet that's involved. I think we had all hoped that Paul Gast would tell us what that meaning is. And while waiting for him, I would like to mention one or two points that seem to me like salient features that emerged from the discussion. First, it seems to me that the old description in terms of the hot and the cold moon is now clearly an oversimplification, and that a richer and more varied set of circumstances is involved in the early history of the moon, such that dichotomy is no longer a useful one to stay with. But that doesn't mean that matters of great interest haven't emerged out of this last 3 days. The outstanding point, it seems to me, is the confirmation that both the dust and the rocks on the moon, with some differences, are very old, between roughly 3.5 and 4.5 billion years old, for the rocks and the dust respectively. And that is the prime circumstance, because it means that we can roll back the curtain on a chapter of the history of the solar system and our own planet, because all of this, by inference, applies to our planet, or much of it. Roll back the curtains on a chapter that's been concealed from our view up to now. We find already indications of a great of happenings, of events. For example, the fact that the rocks at Tranquility Base crystallized about 3.7 billion years ago, whereas the powdered material lying around in that same site is older, suggests that an event may have occurred 3.7 billion years ago. One or more people have suggested that event occurring at that time may be connected with the circumstances that have wiped out the history of the Earth's first billion years, leaving rocks that are no older than about 3.3 or 4 or 5 billion years to be found here. There's no proof for this speculation, but there's no evidence against it either. It's one possibility. Either a volcanic eruption occurred that produced those 3.6 billion year old rocks, when the moon was and the Earth were a billion years old, or perhaps a more general event, a bombardment of the moon and a fortiori of the Earth occurred. One doesn't know yet, but the interesting thing is that you might follow the chain of development that you embark on if you imagine that some major event did occur when the moon was a billion years old, and the Earth. If there was a general bombardment, if it should turn out that other evidence indicates that, then that means that the Earth must have been bombarded even more heavily, since it is a planet with a larger gravitational attraction than the moon. And again, just following this particular line of speculation, one of many possibilities, presumably whatever chemical evolution would have commenced on the Earth in the first billion years of its existence might have been largely or entirely destroyed by that bombardment. If that's true, it means that chemical evolution did not occur in the first billion years of the Earth's history, but occurred when the Earth was, or began over again, let us say, when the Earth was a billion years old. We know that in rocks that are 3.3 billion years old, there are clear signs of the existence of life, of cellular organisms, fossilized bacteria and simple plants, and residues of DNA and RNA, nucleic acids. So we begin to wonder whether perhaps the time scale of chemical evolution can be compressed so that it develops to the one-celled stage in a few hundred million years. It's a purely speculative remark, but it's one chain of thought that develops out of the discovery that the moon contains these early records that are denied to us on the Earth, and that an event occurred on the moon, whether large or small, when it was a billion years old. But it seems to me that with those age figures, we now have the confirmation of the hopes of most of us that we can learn about the early years of the solar system from the study of this lifeless body.
Well, during the discussion by Bob, I see that Professor Paul Gast arrived. He is from Columbia University. I'd like to turn now to Bob Walker and ask for some opening comments also by him.
Well, I guess my first comment would be that quite apart from the scientific aspects of the material and all the data, one thing that I'm very struck with in my own work on the material, and certainly from the photographs that I've seen here, are just the sheer beauty of the material. This dust, which looks like gray material without interest, has exceedingly beautiful and varied forms, just from an aesthetic standpoint, as well, of course, from a scientific standpoint, when you put it under the microscopes. And I, like many others here, have been busy exchanging portfolios of photographs. The material is just beautiful aesthetically, and of course it's beautiful scientifically. Other people have remarked that it's very difficult to absorb everything that's been said, and none of us here have heard everything that's been said. It's impossible to go to the parallel sessions. It's impossible also even to get to the session that you want to go to, because you're always running into someone in the hall that you want to see, wants to see you. And these hall conversations, of course, are one of the very fruitful parts of these meetings. We've gotten into violent arguments on occasion, and there will be more arguments in the future, I'm sure. One thing that I wanted to touch on, which to me is very important, though it has not absorbed a great deal of this conference properly, but is related to the remarks on the age of the surface, is to reiterate the point I made the other day, that one of the interesting features of the moon is that it preserves a record of the sun, and in a way that would be impossible to do with meteorites, in a way that is impossible to do by making observations on any Earth materials, it is possible using the moon materials to go back in time and see what the sun, which is obviously a very fundamental part of the solar system, has been doing in the past. Because of the very great age of the Mare site, it now makes it possible to go back and trace the behavior of the sun almost back to the beginning of the solar system. There are two kinds of activity that one can study. One, of course, is the solar flares, which are recorded in rocks and measured in a variety of ways, and a number of papers have dealt with the subject of solar flare activity. There is, of course, I think you're probably all familiar with this because of the window shade experiment on the moon, the question of the solar wind. Now, the solar wind was collected in a contemporary experiment with that window shade, Geist experiment, by looking at the dust, and in particular looking at the dust at different levels and from different places, and inside these brecciated rocks, it's going to be possible to trace out the past history of the solar wind. The interesting part about the solar wind is that it represents the actual stuff of the sun. It's as if you had in your hands, you were able to dip into the sun and reach out and take this material and bring it back to your laboratory. That's tremendous, particularly when you consider you can do this as a function of time. Now, doing that won't be trivial. That will take years to unravel that whole situation, but it's the clear-cut promise revealed in this first meeting. Now, something else that's interesting, and again in connection with the time scales and the age of the surface, and also of interest in terms of what the future of lunar exploration shall be. One of the more interesting things to me was the evidence, not conclusive, but certainly very suggestive, that the material, some of it, not most of it, but some of it, that you have in this particular Mare site comes from other places. Evidence was presented by several people that some small fragments of rock were clearly different than the average rocks on this part of the moon and could very likely have come from the highland areas. There was one observation, one measurement by Wasserberg of a very old age for one of these small fragments, and that holds out two promises, and those are very great promises indeed. First, that when we go to the highlands, we will go to the highlands, that they're going to be even more interesting from this point of view of the fundamental history of the solar system than the parts that we have already visited. Secondly, that by sampling in a limited way, as we will always have to do, probably, in the next decade, it may be possible to construct a very wide picture of what's been going on the moon on a global scale. There is also evidence presented, and Professor Andrews on my right presented this, for influx, of course, of material from outside the moon system, outside the Earth, that is, meteoritic material on the surface of the moon. So that these samples are not only just representative of one little place, which I think is a logical question that somebody might ask, all this detailed analysis on one little place, how do you know what the whole moon is like? This material does, in fact, give us the promise of getting a very large-scale picture of the moon. Well, perhaps I should stop there. These are two of the things that struck me the most and seem to me the most important.
Thanks, Bob. I would like to note for you that the discovery of a few new minerals in itself does not hold a significance for science, that the discovery of the particular minerals, new minerals, that have been reported at this conference hold for us. I simply want you to recognize that with several thousand bona fide minerals now known, and I guess each year there are several new minerals clearly identified, discovered, that there is special significance that attaches to the ones that are reported at this conference. Now, like most people who speak on something that they're not experts in, I turn to Paul Gast for an elucidation of that statement.
What's that to you?
Well, I think you and Ian are certainly much better qualified to make to elucidate on the point that I'm making.
Let me start off by saying, if many of you are confused, I'm not surprised. Certainly, the kind of things that you hear in the sessions are contradictory. They're in conflict with each other. They're from different points of view. And if you take everything as being of equal value, if you have to, then you're bound to be confused. I'd like to use this occasion to outline things and outline some questions that we're left with and point out some points of controversy or points where there seem to be a lot of activity, where there are a lot of people talking to each other and where there's a lot of disagreement from different points of view, and then perhaps have Ian respond to a couple of these points. I've asked for a blackboard. I'm a professor and I can't function just talking, so I'm going to use the blackboard.
Let's look at a time scale.
We're always looking at time. Say, here's a time scale that starts 4.6 or 4.5 billion years ago. I'm not trying to be accurate. And here we are today. Lunar history. What have we learned on this time scale? Well, this point is not something that I think anybody is surprised by, the fact that we learned that there are 4.6 billion year old materials on the moon. We're quite convinced from the study of meteorites that the time of origin of the solar system, in fact, the time of the origin of the sun, is very near to this time. And whether or not it's 4.7 or 4.6 depends a little bit on the kind of clock that one uses, but there are maybe differences, small differences in the time when things formed at this time, but this general number is widely accepted and not a surprise. What have we learned now? Well, we've learned, let's call this 3.7, that something formed on the history of the moon on the surface of the moon at this time, an igneous rock. I think it's fair to say, even though there is some confusion, particularly with one of the methods, that there is a great deal of certainty that the rocks which we see, the igneous rocks which were brought back, crystallized at this time. This morning we heard results on the potassium-argon method, a beautiful piece of work by Dr. Turner from England, which confirmed very clearly the result that was presented on Monday by Dr. Wasserberg using a different method. The concurrence of these two clocks at this time, I think, really nails us down. So then you say, well, what about all the lead data that we've heard, the lead isotope data? How do we explain this? Well, right now, all we can say is the moon has thrown us a curve there. In a way, it's very good because we're dealing with materials that have very big effects. It was pointed out by Dr. Weatherill this morning that we should not be discouraged by these problems, because the problem arises from the fact that we have very uranium-rich material relative to lead, uranium relative to lead-rich material, and this means that potentially you can resolve very small events. It also has produced some complications in the first look at this material. So let's put that on the shelf. We don't have any questions about this. That's true. Then we have a lot of history between here and here, which interests the people who have, like Dr. Walker, who have just, it was just pointed out that we can study what has happened to the surface now over a long period of time in this particular place on the moon, the irradiation of these materials by solar particles, galactic particles, and so on. I won't say anything about this. Now, we have a chemistry of this material here, and we have the chemistry of the soil, and a lot has been said about what this chemistry means. And we've said things about, interpreted the chemistry of this
in a very broad and general way in many sessions, and you might reasonably ask, why have these kind of things never been said about the Earth? Well, some of them have been said about the Earth, but the Earth is a much more complicated body. It has, we know, much more differentiation, a chemical structure to it, let's say, than the Moon. So it seems like such a hopeless task to reason from something you find at the surface of the Earth to the whole Earth that people just have not attacked this problem. In the case of the Moon, perhaps we're bolder, perhaps also the job is a little bit simpler. Now, if we look at the chemistry, we have a liquid here, and we have some soil, which may be ground up local rock, plus some material added from greater distances. But let's now look at this liquid. The problems are, first of all, let me put out another scale next to this one here and say, what do we know? We know the composition of this liquid. We call them tranquility base basalts. And we know, and we have constantly referred to the composition of chondritic meteorites, the composition of the starting material that went to form planets in the solar system. So we have, say, chondrites. The problem is, how did we get from here to here? Well, we'd like to infer how we got from here to here. Actually, we have to think backwards because this is the last thing that happened. This liquid is produced by some process on the Moon. One of the first things then that can be responsible for its chemical composition is the thing that made the liquid in the first place. The majority of the people here, I would say, tend to think that this liquid came from fairly deep in the interior of the Moon. Although there is not unanimous opinion on that. There are some people who would prefer to produce this liquid on the surface of the Moon. But I think that it's safe to say that the majority of the people, since most of them are petrologists, think that this came from the interior of the Moon. Well, the liquid can further be fractionated by processes that take place when you brought it to the surface, or by processes that take place when it crystallizes. This is a point of controversy between, or a point where there's now a great deal of active discussion. Do you explain the entire composition of this liquid by the thing that produced it in the interior? And many of the petrologists who have done experiments in natural, or in what do you call, synthetic systems where they synthesize material of this, where they take material of this composition, heat it up to the pressure and temperature, the wide ranges of pressures and temperatures, and see what happens when you let it crystallize, and see what minerals can be in contact or in equilibrium with this, interpret the liquid as being coming from the directly from the interior of the Moon. Others would like to let it cook or fractionate on the way up. Now, what do I mean by fractionation? Perhaps I better say something about this. This liquid, when it crystallizes, doesn't crystallize instantly into a mass of solid. It crystallizes over a range of temperatures, and different minerals come out in different orders. Now, there's a great deal of discussion about this particular point because this controls really what the chemistry of the residue is. I mean, we have minerals such as, you may have heard a lot about, plagioclase. Let me spell it. Plagioclase is a mineral which contains calcium, aluminum, silicon, and oxygen. And I won't even confuse you with the whole formula. Perhaps you think I don't know it, but I think that's something that I could prove. This mineral has more aluminum in it, is very rich in aluminum, relative to most common basaltic liquids that we know. So if we remove this mineral from the liquid, then we will, and let it settle out or flow to the surface, as some people have suggested, then this liquid will become depleted in aluminum and we will produce an aluminum-poor residual liquid. Now, there's other minerals we can take out. We can take out the mineral olivine, which contains a high concentration of magnesium in particular. If we take this out, then we deplete the liquid in magnesium. Well, I could extend this list. I'm simply trying to point out to you that what kinds of things we're talking about when we're talking about differentiation. Now, you've heard a lot about perhaps europium anomalies, because many of the chemical studies have revealed, you know, that if you plot the relative rare earth abundances, you find out that one of the rare earths is very different in concentration than all the others. And on these plots, it looks something like this. And this is the rare earth, which has a chemical symbol EU. And this happens to have a freshman chemist can tell, his chemistry student can tell you that this is a different rare earth from the rest of them, because under chemically reducing conditions, those are conditions where iron exists either as ferrous iron or as metallic iron, this exists as the iron EU plus 2 rather than EU plus 3, which is the typical rare earth valence state. Well, it turns out that this ion here is strongly enriched in this mineral, like a very similar ion, the ion strontium. So if we take this mineral out, it is modestly enriched in this mineral. If we take this mineral out, we increase the concentration of all of the other rare earths, which have trivalent ions, and we deplete the liquid in this element here, and you produce exactly this pattern. So by this sort of simple picture, the chemists have come to the conclusion, well, this explains things rather nicely, therefore let's propose that somewhere along the line the liquid that was produced lost a lot of plagioclase, and that this plagioclase accounts for the europium anomaly. Now, other people have looked at the rock and they find little fragments that are very rich in plagioclase, and this is a second piece of evidence that perhaps something like this happened. So that takes us partway back through to this material. We have melting, and we have this crystallization process by which we can reason backward to a different composition. Now, if we believe all this story, and I assure you that many of my colleagues don't believe all what I've told you here, then we can say, if we know now, make some guess at what the starting liquid was, we can compare that to the solid that the liquid was formed from, and maybe guess something about the composition of the interior of the moon, which produced this liquid. Well, if you do this, you come to a conclusion that source of the liquid must be quite different from chondritic meteorites. It is particularly different in that it is very low in elements like sodium, potassium, rubidium, cesium, and a whole host of elements that Professor Anders has determined in the rocks. So you conclude quite safely, I think, that if this liquid, the source of this liquid, in any way represents the moon, or that portion of the moon that it represents, is extensively fractionated or changed with respect to the chondritic parent material. And now the question is, where did this happen? Where did the fractionation take place? Did it take place at some early stage in the history of the moon, when the moon was so hot that these materials, these volatile elements, including water, boiled off and were vaporized into space? Or was the material that went to form the moon from the very primitive material in the solar nebula already different from this chondritic meteorite parent material? And was the moon accumulated out of some primitive material that was depleted in these volatiles? That's a very important question, and that's something which we had some speculation about with regard to the Earth. The Earth is also depleted in some of these elements, not as much as the moon. Now we're back to the very fundamental question about how did planets originate? How did they form? What were the chemical conditions that existed at the time when planets were formed, perhaps at this very early stage that we heard at the banquet, when the sun was a totally different star from what it is today, a much bigger star? The temperatures at the distance of the Earth at this time were much hotter than they are today. The fact that we're talking about these kind of questions, I think, says, yes, we are beginning to answer the question of the origin of planets. Well, I think I'll talk much too long and I'll stop there.
Well, in the hopes of cutting this off by 5 o'clock, I trust that each panel member will not insist on equal time. I believe Ed Anders had a brief comment, an equally brief comment.
Since we're getting near the end, I obviously have to find something new to say. So let me concentrate first on one topic that the other speakers haven't stressed, namely the high quality of the work that has been presented at this conference. First of all, I think if you bump into a scientist at random in the halls, he's more likely to be a first-rater than at any average scientific meeting. And second, you may not have appreciated the very high sensitivity and quality of some of the measurements that have been made. For instance, several people have measured the isotopic composition of lead in the moon and found it to be quite unlike any lead on Earth. Now, in their experiments, something like a billionth of a gram of terrestrial lead has got in as contamination. And this is despite the fact that the work was done in big cities like Los Angeles, Pasadena, etc., where the dust collected from the air contains something like 1% of lead due to the use of tetraethyl lead in gasoline. The work was done in labs equipped with special filters, but when you realize that ordinary dust just seeping in from everywhere contains 1% of lead, and here these people were able to do very elaborate chemistry, taking weeks and weeks on lunar samples, and come out with less than 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram of ordinary lead, this is quite remarkable. Then in the area of noble gases, some of the measurements involved only a few 100,000 atoms, which again speaks for the high sensitivity of the method. And the measurements of precious metals, one has to go a little higher, something like 1 billion atoms or so of gold. In the case of silver, this has become a lot easier since silver coins have practically disappeared, so there's less danger of accidental contamination by sort of paying for your lunch with small change. Then the second point I want to make is that many of us came to this meeting with the notion that all the seas of the moon were 4.5 billion years old. And this certainly looked like a very good assumption prior to this meeting. We've learned otherwise. Professor Gast has told us the Sea of Tranquility, or at least that particular area, seems to be 3.7 billion years old. The results from Apollo 12 rocks show that those seem to be about 2.5 billion years old, although that still needs to be confirmed. Possibly the handwriting is on the wall. And maybe what we are learning now is that the moon has been a geologically active body that has had several episodes of lava flows and other geological activity. In many respects, we still have to do some additional work before we can come back to you with more definitive interpretations. And this is certainly true of some of the age data. But it already seems that some of the evidence presented at this meeting, one discussed and thought about and so on, will give us a much more coherent and a definitive picture of the moon as a whole. And this brings up one important point, namely, after all, the astronauts at Apollo 11 have sampled a very limited area, Tranquility Base, and moreover, there was no time to document the origin of the samples. They picked up whichever rock was nearest. And therefore, the rules of the game for Apollo 11 were very similar to the rules of the game in studying meteorites. You get a sample that's simply handed to you, nobody knows its original context, and what conclusions can you draw from it? I think the people at this meeting have done remarkably well, despite the fact that they didn't really know whether a particular rock came from a foot below the surface or a mile below the surface. And I think in the months to come, when these data are digested, some of these questions will be answered. I think some evidence will begin to come out suggesting that certain types of rocks come from greater depths than others. But in Apollo 12, we'll be in very much better shape because those rocks were carefully documented. They came from some well-studied craters. And therefore, I think the rules of the game will change. It will be very much easier to draw conclusions about them. Still, it is quite a long way from studying rocks from one isolated spot on the moon and then tell an eager audience like you what this means for the moon as a whole and particularly what this means for the average person. It's certainly premature to say a great deal about it. But I will again stress the point that the scientific information which has hailed down upon us in the last few days contains enough clues to these problems of global importance, such as how did the moon as a whole originate, how did the Earth-Moon system originate, that the room for speculation will be narrowed a great deal in the next few months, even before Apollo 12.
And I think you left two misleading impressions. One is that everyone in this room is eager to know the answer to these things, and the other one is the remark about the geological liveliness of the moon. The geologists tell me that 90% of the Earth's surface is covered with rocks that are less than 200 million years old, which is just the blink of an eye. About half the moon's surface is covered with the so-called highlands material, and it's known that the highlands are older than the maria, and we now know that the maria are at least, well, that some of them are 4.6 billion years old. It looks that way. So half of the moon's surface is older than 4.6, or roughly equal to 4.6 billion years.
I think we have to be careful.
No, I'm thinking of the dust. I'm thinking of the dust.
I don't think that's...
No. That's all right, let's say
we have
that...
go over that again.
The dust was dated at 4.66 by one of the PIs, but if you want to concentrate on the rocks, they're 3.6 billion years old, and the highlands are older. So that means that half the moon's surface or more is at least as old as 3.6 billion years. It's a far older surface. Not merely does one piece of it perhaps go back to the beginning of the solar system, but at least half of it goes back very far. There we have learned that it is a more complicated, richer, and interesting history than either of the extremists' schools thought, marked by some lava flows, but not a geologically active body. I think that's
you've provoked me into saying something about this subject that's been discussed entirely too much, namely the age. Let's take a hunk of iron. We seem to agree that any piece of iron you pick up on Earth or you produce on Earth is likely to be older than 4.5 billion years. It was made in the interior of some star. And then General Motors gets a hold of it and makes it into a car. The car has a 1970 nameplate. It is clearly a 1970 model. It was put through a great deal of processing and converted into a car. The nameplate then assures you that a great deal has happened to this shapeless hunk of metal in the year 1970. Then, a few years later, the car is wrecked. It's converted into scrap metal. The evidence of the 1970 event has been erased, and once again, this is a 5-billion-year-old piece of iron. This is the situation of the lunar rocks. The Tranquility-based rocks have gone through a process that changed their chemistry 3.6 billion years ago and sorted them out into several different kinds of rock, which we have called A and B, and there's got to be an E somewhere. We concluded that privately. And then if you make the soil by mixing A, B, and E by impact, spicing it with 4% of highland material and 2% of meteoritic material, and then analyzing the whole bulk sample, you once again establish the fact that this material was made 4.5 billion years ago, because you've really destroyed all the careful chemical separation that took place 3.7 billion years ago. End of commercial.
There's something else to be said, which is where the action is in all of this for the man on the street. I think the point is that these people, the petrologists that you've been hearing, the mineralogists, the geologists, and geochemists, they're trying to unravel the history of the moon as they try to unravel the history of the Earth by looking at the rocks on its surface. What they're about is very much relevant to an astronomical discovery that was made about 3 years ago in the direction of the constellation Monoceros, the unicorn, where at a distance of about 1,000 light years from us, a physicist turned astronomer named Frank Lowe discovered a very funny star which looks exactly like the solar system in the process of formation. It's a star about the size of the sun, but with its radiation very weak. I think it's a factor of 1,000 times weaker than the radiation from our sun, although in the same wavelength, the same kind of star. It is around this sun, there appears to be a cloud of gas and dust radiating infrared radiation at a temperature of a few hundred degrees above absolute zero, exactly the kind of solar nebula out of which we think the planets and the moon and the Earth formed 4.6 or so billion years ago. We never hoped to find a solar system in the process of formation. It takes a long time to make a planet, probably 10 to 50 billion, million years, and so we can't wait around long enough to see what happens to this particular cloud. But the point is, we are trying to find out what the context is in a large scale in which the formation of our planet, our home, on which life evolved 4.5 billion years ago or so, took place, because we know that there are 100 billion other stars, and we have good evidence that most of them have planets around them. We're broadening our horizons, but we were never able to do that while the intense activity that took place on the surface of the Earth when it was a young planet had wiped out the record of the first 1 billion years in its history. The moon has now restored that missing record insofar as we can relate it to the Earth. And that information these gentlemen are developing, combined with what's coming out of astronomy, will give us this larger context in which to view our own physical selves. I think that really should grip, it grips us, and I think it has contact with the feelings of every person, not merely the specialist, regarding what he's doing here on the face of this planet.
Ian, I wonder if you, like Paul, would like to comment upon my matter of the significance of the new minerals.
Well,
I guess I lost the answer to my question.
I'd like to make two comments. I think that from the samples that were picked up, they seem to have come from a relatively wide source area, that the most important process in the original formation of these rocks, as been mentioned before, is that they have formed by the crystallization of silicate melts. And I think this is a very single important process, and it seems to be the main process that has resulted from the original formation of these rocks. And then subsequently they've been subjected to degradational processes which have broken them down to give us the soils and breccias which we see lying on the lunar surface. And then answering more specifically your question there, I think that the interesting thing about the three new minerals, which are now called ferro-pseudo-brookite, spinel, and a mineral called pyrox-mangite, is that all these minerals are expectable from, as crystal precipitates from silicate melts under rather unusual conditions. The difference from the conditions on Earth being that they're very, very reducing conditions. But the structures of these minerals are similar to the structures of minerals that we have found on Earth, or have been experimentally synthesized in experimental systems. But the significant difference, I think, is that it indicates that the conditions of crystallizations have occurred under highly reducing conditions, and this will be, I think, a significant difference between the lunar and terrestrial crystallization. Crystallizing in an environment where the oxygen content is very, very low. Not necessarily a very, very high heat, no. Just low oxygen, low total amount of oxygen. I could say that the oxygen for gas D would be approximately 10 to the minus 13 or 18, but I don't think that's meaningful. Let's see, it would be 10 to the minus 13 or so. Was it, with respect, the atmosphere is 10 to the 0.2, and we're talking about 10 to the minus 13 in this case, of the amount of oxygen. That would be about right.
The partial pressure of oxygen in the atmosphere of the Earth is about a fifth of an atmosphere. The partial pressure of oxygen in equilibrium with a normal basalt is on the order of 100 millionth of an atmosphere. And here we're talking six orders of magnitude lower yet.
Six orders of magnitude lower yet, that's correct. Perhaps one further point I may like to add is that my feeling is that the general interpretation of the origin of the moon has drifted away from tying it with the Earth. And I would like to leave very much open the possibility that the moon still has derived from the Earth. And I think that it's possible to interpret some of the peculiar lunar chemistry in terms of re-examining the earlier history, the earlier differentiation history of the Earth, which unfortunately we don't have a direct record from, but as Dr. Gass pointed out earlier on, we do have quite a bit of evidence of this earlier period, and we have to perhaps go back and look at the evidence again and be a little more courageous in some of our interpretations with the data that we have that bears on this area.
I wonder if there are major items that we have omitted from our statements here today. And I would ask the panelists, if so, let's cover them. And if not, then I want to open the questioning up for the audience. First of all, let me address the panel. Is there something we have omitted that we ought to say now?
Paul said something to me that's important. With attribution to Dr. Gast, he said something to me that I think is important, and it's brief. And that is the essence of a lot of this work is that the moon is a cinder, quoting him. It's dehydrated. It was formed, or in some sense, the surface of it or parts of it were formed at a very high temperature because it's lost the volatile elements and it's lost its water.
I would say one thing.
How has it lost its water? Are you sure there was water there?
Perhaps it never had these elements.
I retract that particular part of the remark.
Sorry.
May I just make one statement? There's a whole class of measurements that Dr. Simmons made, where you are measuring properties that are perhaps somewhat more prosaic than some of these isotope ratios, things like conductivity and electrical properties and so forth, that in themselves are perhaps not exciting, but allow you to do some very important things that you couldn't do before, namely interpret astronomical observations made with radar and optical observations, etc. And just having the material back in the laboratory where you can make these fundamental measurements and quit guessing, as we've had to do in the past, terribly important.
Following on your comment there, I think it's worth also mentioning that we don't really have much information now of the lunar interior. And I think perhaps some of the most significant experiments from the future Apollo missions is going to come from the seismometers that are set on the lunar surface. This, I would like Gene Simmons to speak to this, but I think this still remains one of the big unknowns in terms of our information from the Apollo 11 data. We just do not have data that gives us sufficient resolution to say an awful lot about the lunar interior. And certainly if these volcanic rocks that we see on the surface are derived from this interior, a knowledge of this volume is going to be critical to us.
I have a one-sentence comment, amending my previous statement about the quality of techniques. Several people, including Professor Walker, have actually looked at the effects of individual atoms.
Well, I guess taking up Ian, it's worth putting a plug in at this time for the surface experiments. There's really relatively little at this meeting in the way of discussion of the information that we have learned on Apollo, even on Apollo 11 from the seismometer, and certainly on Apollo 12, which we arbitrarily ruled was out of order, but there are lots of data being accumulated on the magnetic field of the moon. We had hoped on the pressure of the lunar atmosphere, which will certainly be measured on the next and subsequent missions. A plug for one of my own experiments, namely to measure heat flow, which will fly on the next Apollo 13, and so on. There's a whole sequence, a whole spectrum of measurements that will be done on the lunar surface aimed at getting information on the interior of the moon. Along that line, I think it's really fair to say that recorded at this conference as a large amount of undigested data, there has been very little in the way of interpretation other than the kind you've heard at these panel discussions and at some of the press conferences where people who've had very little time to think about the implications of the large amount of data have come up with statements about what it all means. I think you will see in the next 6 months, perhaps a year, many revisions of the statements that people have been making as to what this all means. It's unfortunate from your standpoint. However, there's nothing that can be done about it. I think that it is fair that in the future, much more use will be made of these data in the way of interpretation. And finally, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the data presented at this meeting could really be classed as preliminary, and many of us will continue making measurements during the next few months, and you'll see a large amount of data that is brand new. Some of it will be refined measurements of the existing data and so on. I think let's turn to the audience for questions. I would say let's just ask a general question, and it'll probably be obvious to us who ought to answer it without Victor Cohen saying, let's have Professor G respond, unless you really object to that type of thing. And I would turn to John here because I don't know you, most of you fellows, and it'd be unfair for me to call on the three or four repeatedly that I do know.
Let's just get one or two words on the difficulty of using the lunar surface materials to trace the history of solar radiation. The other evening, Professor Geis talked about the fact that you're getting saturation effects in the lunar surface and so on. Perhaps we can just spell out very quickly what some of those difficulties are.
Well, you can get around that particular problem to some extent. Limitations on, this may sound unjust, but limitations